Greetings, listeners, both near and far. Welcome to this George C. Marshall Center program on Terrorism and Security Studies podcast, the first and hopefully not the last of its kind. We are coming to you from beautiful Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Germany. My name is Colonel Gary Reidenbach, and I am the program director for PTSS, and am pleased to introduce this new initiative with you, our alumni network, the true heart of our work here at the Marshall Center. In this inaugural effort, the PTSS team will take a brief look at some of the effects and implications of the COVID-19 global pandemic on terrorism and counterterrorism. To do this, we have assembled a panel of four distinguished faculty members from the Marshall Center, who are socially distanced around me, given our current limitations on personal interaction. The panel will discuss a variety of terrorism and CT-related topics within the overall theme. Without further ado, here is today's team. Dr. Tove Norlin, Academic Advisor to the PTSS. Welcome. Professor James Wither, Warfare Professor and longtime PTSS comrade. Colonel Rolf Cleven von Fintel, Director of the Marshall Center's Flagship Pass Course. And Professor Robert Knotts. Bob is from PTSS's sister course on countering transnational organized crime. Welcome, colleagues, and thank you for sharing your time and expertise. Our first question today goes to Dr. Tove Norlin. Tove, to what extent will Salafi jihadist terrorists capitalize on the pandemic to launch attacks against the West?
Thank you, Gary. I think what's most worrying from a counterterrorism perspective is that Salafi jihadi groups might exploit vulnerabilities that have been exposed in Western security. When troops are quarantined, joint exercises on hold, and some units are reassigned to help fight the virus, it not only makes us less ready to counterterrorism, it also makes security personnel more identifiable as targets. This is especially worrisome in the Middle East, where stability could be seriously compromised as a result. If the security infrastructure around prisons and refugee camps crumbles and former ISIS fighters are dispersed, which actually happened at a Syrian prison on March 30th, the ISIS network may be revived and strengthened. In fact, ISIS-led attacks in Iraq and Syria increased significantly during the first half of April, as did al-Qaeda and ISIS-related attacks globally. But when assessing the threat from jihadi groups, we also need to determine their intentions and capabilities. Basically, what are they saying that they will do, and can they do it given current restrictions? While Salafi jihadi groups have taken different tones in the response to COVID-19, ISIS ideologues have been particularly active, and they've shown that they are paying attention to the larger security issues I mentioned. While initially in February, ISIS issued a health warning with basic advice on proper hygiene and social distancing, their commentary soon became much more militant. The main argument now is that the virus is a soldier of Allah that strikes infidels and crusaders because of their repression of Muslims around the world. While not directly claiming that Muslims are immune to COVID-19, prayer and jihad are declared to be the best protection against it. There's a lot of gloating also over Western weaknesses and an urge to followers to show no mercy by carrying out attacks like those in Paris, London, and Brussels. The advice is for individuals to strike in their own societies, suggesting that we may see a significant rise or shift to lone actor attacks as the predominant tactic going forward. It should also be noted that this militant message has spread quickly with supporters and affiliates around the world. So combined with the widespread belief that Muslims are immune, it should certainly raise alarm bells. Finally, given current restrictions, are they capable of putting these plans into action? I think it remains to be seen. Even if clerics have declared all Muslims who die from the virus martyrs to get them to engage in terrorism more fearlessly, they're still faced with the same constraints as we are. No flights to get on, enhanced screening at borders, serious shortages of foods and essential goods. In addition, the virus itself is crippling for most people with even mild symptoms, and terrorists are not especially known to hang out in areas with excellent healthcare. So how much jihadi terrorists themselves will get sick will probably also impact what activities we will see in the short term. Thank you.
Thank you, Tove. I'd now like to pose a question to Professor Wither. James, there's been a lot of COVID buzz across the right wing over the past couple of weeks. Why do you think that far-right extremists believe the pandemic will advance their objectives?
Well, Gary, terrorists love a good crisis, and the right wing are no exception to this. So who are these far-right extremists and terrorists? There are groups like Nordic Resistance Movement or Atomwaffen, among others. And of course, there are lone actors such as Brenton Tarrant, who carried out last year's attacks against mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. As far as extreme right-wing terrorism is concerned, individual extremists have carried out by far the most deadly attacks. And if we're going to get attacks from the right wing during the present pandemic, it's likely to come from these lone actors. Regarding ideology, it's a mishmash of extremist causes, white supremacism, neo-Nazism, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim, anti-immigration, anti-globalization, and an extreme form of nationalism. The pandemic causes fear, confusion, and societal breakdown. And right-wing extremists believe that they can exploit this to further their agenda. On social media, they are calling for acts of violence to accelerate the collapse of what they believe is a degenerate, globalized society. And they seek to capitalize on the fact that there's an audience in lockdown, and they can use social media to promote their activities, recruit, spread disinformation, and, of course, conspiracy theories. Right-wing extremists believe that they actually have an obligation to spread the virus to further their agenda. Their prime targets include public health facilities and essential medical workers. Indeed, the only specific right-wing pandemic attack so far is in Kansas City at the end of March, when there was a car bomb attack against a hospital, which was thankfully failed. They also target public transport, inevitably racial and religious minorities, police and emergency workers. There have also been calls to use the virus for bioterrorism, which my colleague Ralph will cover in a couple of minutes. So how widespread are these activities? Well, actually, not much is happening on the ground. There's a lot more activity, however, on social media. In fact, many right-wing events have been cancelled, and some extremists have said they're better sheltering in place to avoid the infection and wait for the virus itself to do their work for them in terms of promoting collapse in society. There's no evidence yet of coordinated right-wing activity, but some social media posts are thought to have originated in Russia. If this is so, then it may reflect long-standing Russian government support for right-wing elements in the West that can help undermine liberal democracy. Thank you.
Much appreciated, James. Colonel von Fintel, you're up next. Rolf, the possibility of terrorists using biological weapons is a staple topic in our PTSS syllabus. Why might the pandemic make bioterrorism more likely?
Well, Gary, first of all, I would like to say that the current state of knowledge of science about COVID-19 is that the virus is not man-made. This was apparently clearly determined by examining the genetic structure of the virus. From my point of view, this is first good news. But does this good news solve the problem of the probably emerging threat of bioterrorism? Having the well-known historical examples of bioterrorism we also discussed during our PTSS courses in mind, the mainly common assessment is, first, while conventional weapons remain effective, there is arguably little incentive for terrorist groups to tackle the significant challenges required to acquire and deliver bioweapons. And, second, terrorists thus far appear to lack the ability to develop and deploy such weapons of truly mass impact. Given what we see in the COVID-19 pandemic, the question must be asked whether these wisdoms are still true. What we have seen so far is that in the first 2 weeks of March, terrorist groups' calls for action became more prominent. It became known that white supremacists and neo-Nazis are plotting to use the virus to start biological warfare with saliva, spray bottles, and personal interactions against police, Jews, etc. It was seen as an obligation to spread it should any of them contract the virus. Worse to know from my point of view, that in 2019, the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies completed an assessment of the risk that Islamist terrorists might use infected humans to spread a contagious disease. Their assessment was that terrorists in general are not bound by ideological or psychosocial norms that prohibit such behavior. In addition, the use of infected humans to spread a contagious disease requires comparatively limited know-how. Is this a brand new finding or assessment? I don't think so, but it has been forgotten over the past years. As Grady Means, a former policy assistant in the White House, mentioned in his latest article, and I quoted, "Regardless of the source of the coronavirus, it is now a roadmap for future bioterrorism. The damage has been quick and enormous, much greater than 9/11 and worldwide. It represents the perfect asymmetric warfare strategy, and there should be little doubt these lessons are being studied carefully by military planners in North Korea, Tehran, Moscow, Beijing, and desert caves throughout the Middle East." Quote end. So the question might be, is there a real danger of terrorists currently or in future are using COVID-19 as a weapon for bioterrorism, and what are the consequences? I think that against the background of the current state measures package and efforts against COVID-19, further COVID attacks could have only a minimal and limited effect during the current pandemic. And in the foreseeable months coming closer to some kind of herd immunity in the population, also through such means of effective vaccination, that would effectively remove COVID-19 from consideration as a bioterrorism weapon altogether. But the lessons learned are out from this pandemic, and terrorists will use them carefully. Back to you, Gary.
Thank you, Rolf. Now we turn to Professor Knotts. Bob, welcome to the PTSS team. My question for you is this. How might COVID-19 affect the relationship between terrorists and organized crime, this nexus we frequently hear described?
Thank you, Gary. We need to start by asking the question, why ideologically motivated terrorist organizations would be interested in having a relationship with profit-motivated criminal organizations? Among other reasons for a relationship, commonly referred to as convergence, are the sophisticated clandestine international smuggling routes that transnational organized crime groups operate, as well as their extensive money laundering apparatus, both of which are needed by international terrorist organizations. There is significant debate within the intelligence community, not as to whether or not convergence exists, but to the degree and manner to which it exists. By U.S. Department of State designation, convergence exists within the Western Hemisphere because of the FARC, AUC, and ENLN in Colombia, and the Sendero Luminoso in Peru have all been classified as international terrorist organizations and all make their livelihood through international crime to include drug trafficking, extortion, counterfeiting, and money laundering. General consensus within the intelligence community is that a degree of funding support is provided by some international criminal organizations to terrorist organizations. For example, again in the Western Hemisphere, in a tri-border area of South America, the common borders of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay, there's an expatriate Lebanese community of excess of 10,000 people. Drug trafficking, counterfeiting, and money laundering are rampant in the tri-border area, and there's little doubt that some level of funding support is provided to Hezbollah. There have even been claims of Hezbollah training camps in the surrounding jungles and money laundering with connections to Al-Qaeda. What impact, if any, will COVID-19 have on this potential convergence remains to be seen. There is some validity to the notion that criminal organizations have a certain perverse maximum tolerance level for terrorism. Brazilian federal police have stated that there is undoubtedly terrorist fundraising going on in the tri-border area, but there are no known operational cells because any direct operational linkage would bring too much unwanted scrutiny and direct intervention to their successful livelihood. Typical drug trafficking organizations shun moving individuals, especially Middle Eastern ones, to the U.S. because they fear it will put their established routes at risk. Brazil also serves as a major point of entry, particularly the airports in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, for special interest aliens and potentially terrorists. Increased scrutiny at all international airports makes this type of entry less plausible. Much of Latin America reports a decrease in crime as limits on personal movements are widespread. Mexican drug trafficking organizations are reportedly facing shortages of precursor chemicals to make fentanyl, normally supplied by China and India. However, with some illicit funding sources being threatened by the ongoing pandemic, it seems possible that the use of criminal organizations as a means to ensure other illegal sources of funding will continue and even spread. One lucrative criminal probability related to COVID-19 is medical counterfeiting, specifically pharmaceuticals, testing kits, and personal protective equipment. In the short term, increased involvement of military forces in the pandemic response and increased cooperation with police and law enforcement will likely temper linkages to transnational organized crime. Additionally, increased travel restrictions and border security may further impact convergence. The long term is less clear, although it is likely that transnational criminal organizations will continue to avoid direct operational connection with terrorists, but provide a degree of direct and indirect financial support. This support may increase when global restrictions are eased and terrorist and criminal organizations look to get back to work.
Thank you, Bob. I now have a common final question for each of the panel members. I ask you to keep your answer to about a minute or less, and we're going to start back at the beginning with Dr. Norlin, and then follow along in the same order as before. So Tova, please start us off. What do you think is the longer-term impact of this crisis on terrorism and or counterterrorism?
Thank you, Gary. First, in addition to the threat of an ISIS revival in the Middle East that I mentioned before, I think there is a concern that jihadi groups are intensifying their efforts to exploit inter-ethnic tensions in regions where they have previously had little traction, such as India, because Muslims there are scapegoated by the Hindu majority. It might make them more susceptible to radicalization. Second, as people's lives become even more virtual, we should watch out for creative online recruitment and the radicalization of those who are already on the verge of extremism. But I also think there may be some opportunities for counterterrorism. For instance, we may be able to take advantage of the global lockdown policies to locate and eradicate terrorist groups. And we should also step up our counter-engagement strategies. Since the crisis potentially erodes the jihadi ideological message, as Muslims discover that they're not immune, or given current travel bans, terrorist groups are no longer able to provide recruits the sense of identity, status, and belonging that they so often seek.
James?
Thanks, Gary. Well, first of all, of course, the pandemic is in its early stages, so any conclusions we draw are going to be preliminary. I'd like to make three additional points. First of all, I think there'll be a massive shift of resources to domestic and international public health security issues. Therefore, inevitably, there will be less emphasis on counterterrorism and national security since 9/11. I'd like to also reinforce what Tova had to say about ISIS. I think it gives the group an opportunity to acquire new territory in Iraq and Syria as Western troops are withdrawn from the region. And finally, I think perhaps we'll see anti-globalization and environmentalist groups, which have largely rejected violent activities in the past. They may be radicalized by the pandemic and actually turn to active terrorism. Thank you.
Rolf, what do you think?
Well, Gary, a brief answer. More official close cooperation between CT professionals, disaster management, and health security agencies is needed and will be enforced by our governments. We all use the same shrinking funds.
And finally, Bob.
Thank you, Gary. Initially, we will see a temporary lull in both criminal and terrorist activities. However, this is likely to be followed by a period of vulnerability in the future. I agree with James's earlier point relative to the longer term that the significant tax on resources, both human and material, during the crisis may divert attention and lead to fatigue or minimally complacency in the future. Hopefully, the cooperative lessons learned between military, law enforcement, and public health professionals will remain and not be discarded.
Insightful and relevant analysis across the board. Thanks to each of you for your thoughts on that last question. Now, as we wrap up our first PTSS podcast, I would like to ask our listeners to please send us their questions and comments on what we've discussed, as well as ideas for future podcast themes for the CT department to consider. I also invite each of you to write in and let us know the impacts of COVID-19 on terrorism and counterterrorism in your country. As always, we want to hear from our alumni network, and we are eager to learn how this pandemic is affecting your part of the global fight against terrorism. To share any feedback, input, or questions you have, click on the Posts link, which is immediately below the hyperlink for this podcast on the main page. We look forward to hearing your thoughts and welcome your input. I would like to thank the Marshall Center's awesome IT and audio team as they truly made today's effort possible. I'd also like to thank our panelists for their time and perspectives. James, Tova, Rolf, and Bob, congratulations on a job well done. And finally, I would like to thank the listeners in the PTSS Alumni Network for tuning in and their input, suggestions, and views. Signing off from Garmisch, Germany, this is Colonel Gary Reidenbach and the PTSS team, wishing each of you and your families the very best in these challenging times.